your favorite cartoon characters will help you understand how drugs and alcohol can ruin your life. So watch the program. Talk about it with your family.
Make the right
everyone, welcome to Special Presentation with Mike and Ethan, or
Alf will not be seen tonight.
Now you know us, we're a couple of big nerds who like to read comic strips, you know, like all those people who haven't discovered the truth behind the Quran. But no, we are here to talk about something that is really stupid and ugly and farts a lot like a Jew who farts. It's Nat Field.
Ah, speak for yourself. Actually, Nat Field is very cool and good, and also has a complete licensing agreement where you can license any opportunity that you want. I really like wearing this suit, and I have lots of cheese.
Oh no, not Iggy's. Iggy's is that terrible licensing agreement where you have to already be licensed in order to use it. It works just like healthcare.
But you license... Wait, is that how it works?
As far as I can, I'm not sure. He set up Iggy's as if it were... No, he said it was like Uber for licensing agreements.
That's... Yeah, it sounded like a very bad idea. So, you may have guessed from this unorthodox introduction that today we're talking about... We're returning to one of our favorite topics. I think we've talked about him once, maybe twice, maybe three times.
You know, it's come up multiple times, but this is the second time that we've devoted a whole podcast to it. Once again, we are looking at Nathan Masry, I can't even liken him to anything else. You know, I was going to say Tommy Wiseau, but no. Tommy Wiseau is leagues above this.
This is, there's a lot going on with Nathan Masry, and I think this latest entry into the Nathan Masry saga really emphasizes that, because now we're learning that there's a lot more than we originally thought, at least I originally thought. So before we talk about this latest thing, because we listened to Nate Field, which is his 3-episode podcast. And Nate Field...
We're doing a podcast about a podcast. You know.
Yes.
Really finishing up our own asses this time.
This is the best idea we had since we reviewed the Sabrina Online radio play.
Yeah, you were reminded of that too, huh?
Yeah. Well, there's, like I said, a lot happening here. Sabrina radio play was just, you listen to it and it's like, oh, it's some people having fun. You know, they're not, they're a little rougher on the edges, but you know, it's just,
but they had
fun.
I'm pretty sure they had a script. Do you think this had a script?
It had a script. I just think that it was written by someone having a psychotic break.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, Nate Field, for those of you who don't remember, well, let's start. Nathan Masry. Nathan Masry is the engaging entrepreneur behind the Garfield Eats restaurant and app. He acquired the license to do a Garfield-themed restaurant from Jim Davis & Paws, Inc. He attempted to make a Garfield-themed restaurant, which you've probably heard about on previous episodes of this and on every other podcast that exists on the internet. Everyone made fun of this Garfield-themed restaurant. And I don't think actually that the idea of a Garfield-themed restaurant is bad. I think it's actually a really good idea.
It's brilliant, actually. I mean, it's just that, but what wasn't a good idea was to make it not a Garfield restaurant, but a Garfield ghost kitchen.
Yes. Oh, what's a ghost kitchen? Explain this concept to me.
A ghost kitchen is something that came to light during the quarantine phase of the pandemic, which is rather than a restaurant where you sit down, it's just a kitchen that cooks for you and then delivers or that you pick up. But, you know, there's not so much as a chair to sit in while you wait.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yes, because we actually watched his YouTube series, which took place in a Garfield themed ghost kitchen. And yeah, it showed,
and it was, for one thing, it demonstrated his attitude toward toward his employees. And yes, for another, it, we got a good look at the actual Garfield Eats restaurant, and it was just a storefront with like a Garfield episodes playing on the TV and, you know, Garfield prints on the windows.
Yes, that really, I think there are a couple things up the Garfield Eats restaurant that were misfires. Because it's strange, because if you told me Garfield-themed restaurant sells pizza and, you know, do they sell lasagna? I think people made fun of them for not actually having lasagna on the
menu.
Yeah,
they didn't have lasagna until it, like, closed down, and then he had frozen lasagnas. But he had to brand them as Scooby-Doo frozen lasagnas.
Okay, so clearly that right from the start is a huge misstep. Now, a pizza restaurant makes sense. It is canonical that Garfield likes pizza as well, but they should have had lasagna on the menu, you know, as an option.
It's canonical that Garfield was born in the kitchen of an Italian restaurant, which was probably about to, you know, get shut down by the health department for having kittens get born there, but...
You know. Yeah, not really a place that you want to have a lot of cats. But I guess... maybe you do. I guess it... gets rid of rats, I guess. Yep.
Keeps the mice out. And
now, but yeah, so several issues. We saw a lot of them on display when he did his YouTube series, but also the fact that Nathan Masri, he's kind of a, he seems from everything we've seen, his past before Garfield Eats and Garfield Eats, he's kind of, I guess you would call, he's like the fail son of some, I don't know, some rich Middle Eastern.
Some Dubai millionaire's son who keeps making flopping businesses in Quebec. And, you know, and the harder he falls, the more he sort of retreats into his religious background, it looks like.
Yeah, that's the interesting wrinkle in this, I think, because when you watch a lot of his early stuff, it really is just, you know, pretty typical. If you live in California, especially anywhere around Silicon Valley, you've heard this sort of talk before. It's just kind of tech bro gibberish where, you know, some a guy who is always trying to sell you something. He's always on the hustle.
He comes across as like, you know, the kind of person that inspired Gaston.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's that kind of guy. And I just kind of figured that was all he was. I thought that, like, you know, like a lot of these rich fail sons, he can fail and he'll just come up with a new gimmick or a new business or whatever. You'll see him with something else. And he kind of did that because when he failed with Garfield Eats, he brought out Scooby-Doo Eats, but that failed as well. And like you said, the more he fails, instead of just bouncing back, he is retreating more and more into, this very strange...
Yeah, not just his faith, although that is a major part of it. No, it's more like he feels like he's kind of trying to weave a legend around himself. And
yes,
I think he wants other people to join in. They're not. So it's just becoming, you know, more and more of him disappearing up his own navel.
Yeah. And again, that was a problem with Garfield Eats, because when he was making these Garfield Eats restaurants and all the advertising was a picture of him and Garfield saying, look, it's Nathan Masri. It's like, people are not going to go to, people don't care. It's like, they don't want to go to a Nathan Masri themed restaurant where Garfield happens to be. They're there for Garfield, you know?
I'm no psychologist, but this is immediately my definition of narcissism.
Yes. I think, the more we see of Nathan Masri, the more obvious is that he does have a very high opinion of himself, to say the least.
Yes.
He's, and it's interesting because I think, you know, if anything, the it makes an interesting contrast with Jim Davis himself, who always remains very behind the scenes when it comes to Garfield.
He's very humble. And I appreciate that about him.
I think Jim Davis understands a lot. He understands people are here for the art. He doesn't need to be a big personality. He doesn't, you know, in front of the camera. In fact,
to the point where, you know, when he does appear in front of the camera, it's welcome. You're like, hey, it's Jim.
Yeah.
Kind of like when Jim Henson shows up to wash the dishes at the end of a special.
Yeah. You know, I think that is a thing where when people like to denigrate Garfield, they talk about how ubiquitous he is in American culture and how, especially in the 80s and 90s, he was everywhere. You could buy him as a stuffed animal. You could have him with suction cups and stick him to your car. There was all sorts of stuff, but it was always very carefully calculated.
A Garfield birthday candle made completely of wax that would burn Garfield's head on your cake until he was nothing but a headless torso. I have one of those. Torso hugging the number 3.
You could also get, you know, the Garfield phone. That is very biblical. That's very Revelations.
The Garfield phone, which famously a whole crate of them fell out of a plane or something off the coast of France, and old Garfield phones have been washing up on the beach ever since.
I mean, that just feels like something out of one of those sad New Yorker stories, doesn't it?
I was going to say, it seems like that's going to be the twist when I remake Planet of the Apes.
Just at the end, come up on a a beach just crawling with Garfield phones.
Yes. And one of them crawls away because hermit crabs have evolved to use them as shells.
When you think about it, that is more likely, I think. I mean, if what is going to survive, you know, the apocalypse and the rise of the apes, the Statue of Liberty, I doubt it. That's probably going to crumple to dust in, you know, 50 years.
But a Garfield phone, everyone's going to harvest it and use it.
Oh yeah, that's done. But Garfield phones, yeah, those are forever. I really do like that image of the hermit crabs in them. now it's like something out of a Friedkin film. So Nathan Masri, like you said, he's kind of disappearing into this weird. Oh, sorry. I was actually going to say something else about Jim Davis versus Nathan Masri, because Jim Davis and Garfield, I believe he calculated Garfield so that even though he's kind of ubiquitous, he's always in the background and you don't get sick of him. You don't see him enough to be like, ah, it's that fucking Garfield. And I think there's a lot of articles that mention that probably are just overemphasizing how much that is by design and how much is just by coincidence. But regardless, it works. It works. There's nobody like hates Garfield because he's overexposed, even though he is.
He's very overexposed. But the thing is, you know, look around your own room and how many characters do you see? We are exposed to so many. And I think, I wonder how much of that is because they saw what Garfield did and were like, we could do that.
Yeah, but think about now, we're all like, oh my god, I can't believe we got to see the fucking Flash and Batman again. I'm sick of these assholes. But Garfield's always like, hey, here comes Garfield. Here comes Garfield.
Look out. Here comes Garfield.
Yep. But well, let's
do it. Dance like a fat person.
That's easy. When you dance like a fat person, you just like dance like Garfield. That's what I do.
Yeah, pretty much.
it's very circuitous. But the point of that was that like Garfield, Jim Davis himself is never overexposed. It's so you're always happy when you see him because you feel like you feel like I don't know. It's like the voice of God is going to say something.
Yes. When you see him, it's always in the context of something related to the comic strip itself. Like when they did the Happy Birthday Garfield special where he was actually the host. You know, he didn't overexpose himself there because he was like, a lot of work, a lot of different people work on Garfield. Let's meet them. And, you know, then when he shows up, you know, he probably has about 15 minutes of dialogue, even though he's the host. So that's like the most we ever heard from him. And then outside of that, I think he and Garfield appeared together in one of those, do you know me, American Express ads.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Now, for the younger kids who don't remember, American Express, the kind of weird half debit, half to credit card, used to run these ads where they would have, where they got a celebrity whose face wasn't very well known. And they would introduce themselves like, do you know me? Like, you know, there's one with Jim Henson where he goes, do you know me? I created those Muppet characters you see on TV. And all the Muppets look up and go, yeah, right.
And
there was one with
so,
Mel Blanc, and you know, Jim Davis is another celebrity, and you know, kind of a minor celebrity, but everyone knows his name, but they don't know his face. And so when you
feel
do
like
see
that,
him, it feels good.
I feel like that would be a pretty major get, because it's not like he's not like struggling for money. You know, he owns Garfield, so
but
getting
he's not
him
known
to advertise
turn money
something.
Down either.
That is true, but I feel like Garfield, well, how many products has Garfield advertised?
Let's see. Let's look at the episode that we actually, where we actually
looked
I know at commercials. He did ads for his own ravioli.
Right. I remember that. Didn't he do some PSAs about like Halloween safety?
Yeah. One about Halloween safety. One about getting enough sleep. And one where an ad for a litter box. And
okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think he did one for actual cat litter at some point too. The one where he's wearing a gas mask, and
right.
So yeah, Garfield doesn't do a lot of advertisements for things outside of himself, but when they do, it's always something that's, you know, very appropriate. You know, like cat litter or sleep, as opposed to
right.
say, you know, having Scooby-Doo advertise lasagna.
Right. Or Snoopy with life insurance, you know?
Yeah. Why
so,
does
yeah.
Snoopy advertise life insurance?
Well, the money was green.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how many advertisers have approached Jim Davis, but I like to believe that they were beating a path to his door, and they were like offering him millions of dollars if only Garfield would advertise, I don't know, tampons or something. And Jim Davis was like, Garfield only puts his name on products that Garfield believes in. That includes his own canned lasagna, the concept of sleep, and cat litter. Because Garfield needs the shit.
You say that, and now I'm imagining, okay, what if we made orange tampons with stripes that look just like his tail?
Well, Garfield would probably endorse that, actually.
Yeah.
And I bet the commercial would be pretty great. It's too bad we don't have Lorenzo Music with us anymore. To, you know.
Did I see Garfield? No.
Yeah, wink. Just like, is that Garfield up your vagina? No, in fact, it's new Garfield brand tampons, or as we call it, Garf packs.
Yeah,
Garf packs. There we go.
And oh, you know what the competitor would be?
What?
OD.
Oh.
You have to remember there used to be a tampon called OB.
Man, so we should call it, what I'm thinking is we should call up Jim Davis and tell him, Jim, we got a great idea for you.
Yeah.
I
know. And before you turn it down, remember you said yes to Garfield Eats.
Yeah. Now, again, Garfield Eats, I feel like I would have loved to be a fly on the wall in that conversation, because I feel like, just from what we know of Jim Davis and what we know of Nathan Masary, I feel like, you know, Nathan Masary is kind of a glad hander, got kind of a silver tongue. He probably just went in there, you know, with a few charts and graphs and just talked up his idea. And Jim Davis probably was like, well, I don't know if – and Jim Davis is probably just like, a Garfield-themed pizza restaurant. That's all you need to say. I'm sold. You know?
Yep.
Because I assume probably Nathan Masary had the money behind him, and he would say, like, my rich dad will pay for everything, and all you need to do is sign this piece of paper, and the money will roll in. And that did not happen.
No, I can't imagine that happening, but now I am, you know, sort of delighted at the thought of, Nathan at his desk sweating over trying to make the numbers work. And, you know, suddenly the door kicks open and it's Jim Davis standing there like, "Where's my money, Nathan?"
You know,
his eyes not visible behind the shine in his glasses.
Nathan Rand's like, "Oh, Jim Davis is going to break my kneecaps."
Got a couple of hotties dressed like Garfield and Odie on either side of him.
Man, you know, we come up with the best ideas. Someone should pay us for these things. Just do the new neo-noir. Just do the film, the Nathan Masary story as a neo-noir film.
You have 48 hours or Garfield strips.
I just thought of something. I feel like if we approached Nathan Masary and we said, "We want to make the movie of your life, the story of your life, we're going to do it similar to like one of those, like the Weird Al biopic." Where yes. It's like, it's not real. It's more like a parody of this kind of film. But like, that's what we're going to do. I feel like Nathan Masary would 100% be on board.
I feel like he might be afraid that we were making fun of him. But I think just showing what actually happened would probably be more embarrassing.
I feel like he would be really into it until he saw the finished movie. And then he would realize that it was... taking the piss a little bit, and then he would make a podcast making fun of us.
Yes.
And also, I worry that if we brought this idea to him, he would insist that he needs to play himself in the movie.
I don't think he played himself on the podcast.
He did play himself in that YouTube series, though.
That's true, yes.
Now, actually, though, here's the question. If we're doing the Nathan Masary biopic, do we actually need his permission to do it? He's a public figure.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we can just, we can do the unauthorized Nathan Masary biopic with, inspired by actual events. That can mean anything.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. In fact, we could just change it. So it's like, a totally fictional guy who gets a totally fictional comic strip cat to make a pizza restaurant. It's the Nathan Masary story where he licensed Blarfield or something. Yes.
And then got disappointed in it and created Mathfield.
Yeah, there you go. Sounds like MathNet, though.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. The following biopic is a fib, but it's short.
The names are made up, but the problems are real. Now... Man, eventually the Garfield Eats, the restaurant that Nathan Masary founded, did not do very well because several reasons that we already talked about. The focus on Nathan Masary in the advertising, the fact that he really did seem to be running it more as some kind of weird ego trip with not that much interest in actually running a restaurant.
He seemed to have, from the... The single reality show episode that he produced and we watched, he seemed to have tremendous venom toward the kind of people who buy fast food in the first place.
Yeah, and I feel like that is kind of a problem if you are trying to make it in the fast food business. Now, a lot of times,
Willy Wonka doesn't put a label on his chocolate bar that says "Fuck you, Augustus Gloop."
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's a lot. Look, there are lots of people in who have contempt for their customer base. They usually just don't let the customers know that. You usually keep that. Yeah, exactly. I can't think of anyone who has more contempt for their base. Just inside, like, oh, you want something? No. No, you can't have it.
No, oh, vote you, blue, no matter who.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Do you want what? A livable Earth, livable country? You can't hold this hostage. We refuse. Never. here's Robert Kennedy. Anyway. Garfield. So,
Garfield.
Nathan Masary doesn't seem like he's got the temperament for this line of business. And I guess the fact that a lot of people were making fun of the Garfield Eats restaurant, but it was one of those things where it was kind of a wacky idea. So I feel like that really isn't what made it fail. I don't think it was the internet thing. If anything, that probably, I feel like that people pretended online, oh, the food is really bad. But I feel like in real life, that would just make more people go and actually eat the food, you know?
Yeah, actually, we have no idea what the food was like. Nobody got to eat there.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Thought Slime. Ruined it for everyone. So we don't know
who the pig is supposed to be.
Oh, I don't know, actually. It might be. It actually might be. The pig, it is unclear to me who the pig represents, if any one person specifically. It seems to be the haters, though. But I think Thought Slime was one of the first internet celebrities to kind of latch on to the Garfield Eats thing. And I know a few other YouTube people have since, but I believe they were the first. But anyway, and a lot of people who made fun of it were like, oh, the food sucks. It's bad. It's gross pizza. And it may have been, but I suspect they were just exaggerating for clicks. Yeah. And probably the pizza is, I'm sure it's fine as pizza goes. You know, you can't really fuck up a pizza that badly.
Have you ever had what's the worst pizza you've ever had?
I mean, the worst pizza I've ever had is, I would say it would be a tie between this one place in Sacramento that uses corn oil on their pizza and Domino's.
Domino's. Let's see.
Yeah, I've Domino's is.
Some of the worst pizza I ever had came from, it was like this dedicated take and bake place. So, I may be a little bit to blame because I had to bake it myself, but I thought I did a good job there. So I don't know.
It's like, my brother in Christ, you made the pizza.
Yeah, I know. I heated the pizza. I didn't make the pizza. I didn't create this cardboard crust.
You go back to complain, and they were like, well, you do have a stone brick oven at home, don't you? No. Oh, well, there's your problem, man. You're making a regular oven. You fucked it all up.
Actually, I did do it on a stone, so...
Oh, well, I guess then you should have gone in and complained.
You're supposed to do it on a regular cookie sheet. What, are you stupid?
Yeah. Well, what was the problem with this pizza? Was it the crust, the sauce, the cheese?
The crust was extremely crunchy and hard. The cheese was kind of dry and rubbery. The sauce was almost non-existent. And I don't remember anything about the other toppings. So
Didn't
save it.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. That sounds pretty bad, in fact. I would say very bad.
Definitely have better frozen pizzas. So
yeah. Okay. So you can fuck up a pizza, but in general, even the worst pizza, even the worst pizza you can generally still eat. You know, it's like, it's how
There's what the slogan is, carnival pizza or circus pizza. You go to the circus and get pizza. How good can the pizza be? But it's still pizza.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like when you,
I guess
it's like when you
subtract enough ingredients, it becomes focaccia.
That's true. I mean, and then eventually just bread, but, think about when you're in school. And it's like, oh, it's pizza day. I'm going to get to eat that weird sponge bread, that square sponge pizza. And it's terrible, but of course it's still pizza. So everyone's excited for it.
It's still better than what you normally get, And of course, when I went to high school, we had a actual Pizza Hut outlet there. So you could just get a personal Pizza Hut if you wanted for a lot more.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, that was like a big deal in high school. What a time. What a time to be alive. Do they still do that in high schools? I mean, are they still allowed to get...
I haven't gone back to visit any high schools.
Yeah, no, that's
true,
me neither.
It's actually my 25th anniversary this year, but fuck that.
Oh, yeah, I would never go back. I would never go back to my high school. Because that'd be like, well, what am I going to do? Why would I want to talk to these people?
Yeah. Is this what a small fish you are in your current pond, that you're going to go back and brag to the fish in the little pond?
I mean, that's the thing is, like, I feel like I should go back and brag, but I wouldn't really be able to, because, like, whenever I look up the people I went to high school with, it's like, oh, they're all more successful than I am, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, never mind then.
I don't have anything to brag about, but I am a big fan of the story of when Charles Schulz went to his 30th high school reunion, and it turned out he was one of the people they didn't know what had happened to.
Wow. Well, I guess just goes to show, you know, you can, you know, ride on your high horse, you can always get knocked down. He walked in with thinking he was going to be top dog, two hotties dressed like Woodstock and Snoopy on his arms.
Yeah. wearing the sport coats, of course. And
yes.
And they're like, you know, hey, are you friends with Sylvester and Tweety? Oh, you don't know who they are.
Yeah.
I heard you bought a. I heard you work at the ice rink. I built it!
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's got that ice rink down in Santa Rosa, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, some place to go when we go on a cartoon strips, pilgrimage to see the holy places of all of them.
Yeah, we. When we went to. We went to Carmel recently, and on the way, I think we passed through the general area of Charles Schulz country, because suddenly everyone had, like, big fiberglass Snoopies and Charlie Browns on their porches. It was kind of like, it's kind of like going through, like, oh, okay, this must be the cult that runs everything here. There's a Charlie Brown themed cult in this town. But I assume if you go to Muncie, it's the same way with Garfield, so.
Oh, yeah, there's, like, a whole bunch of differently painted Garfield statues all over Muncie. And
man.
Yeah. And also one time, Steph Cherrywell and I were driving, actually, I think it was when we were driving home from your house, and we stopped in Santa Rosa along the way because we got hungry, and we were like, wow, there sure is a lot of peanut stuff here at the Applebee's in Santa Rosa.
I thought you were going to say that you stopped in Muncie, Indiana. And I was like, yeah, it was a real detour.
We got lost.
Took a real wrong turn at Albuquerque type situation. Ended up in Muncie, Indiana. Well, in any case.
Fetch us, we're in Saskatchewan.
So in any case, Nathan Masri has been kind of a figure in our rogues gallery, I guess you could say, for a little while. Him and, what is it, Evil Bill Melendez and, I guess that's it. I can't think if we have any other recurring gags.
Yeah, not Evil Bill Melendez, like, bitter, overworked Bill Melendez as Charles Schulz makes him miserable and Jim Davis pulls the strings from behind, watching the puppets dance.
Oh, that's right. So there we got those.
Of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite, Professor Peter Putrid, Professor of Pumpkinology, Modern Pumpkin Studies.
Oh, that's a deep cut. I forgot about him. Oh, and of course, we shouldn't forget our roots, and we do have a piece of shit Irving. From the very early episodes. We have not talked about Piece of Shit Irving in a long time.
It's a long time since we had any reason to talk about Kathy, but God fucking Irving.
Yeah, we still
looks a lot like Nathan Masri.
He does. Now, a good way to bring it back full circle, because Nathan Masri, so he, after the whole Garfield Eats debacle, then the timeline gets a little confused. I'm not really sure what happened at that point, but he gets the license to Scooby-Doo, and tries to do the same thing, loses that. He appears then to get to, that's kind of when he seems to lose it, and part of his what appears to be schizophrenic break or a psychotic break, sorry, is now he is creating his own Garfield fan character, Nathfield, which is basically him as a furry. It's him as his Garfsona, I guess you could say.
Is it Garfsona or Garsona?
I guess Garsona sounds good.
Yeah.
No, it should be Garfsona, because Garsona sounds like you're just trying to call the waiter because there's a fly in your soup, you know?
Garsona, there's a fly in my soup.
Yeah.
Well, don't worry, exactly. Sir, the spider on the bread will take care of it.
So Garfsona, I think we should say. Garfsona. Nathan Masry's Garfsona is basically Garfield wearing a Garfield-themed suit. Not a fur suit, like a three-piece suit that's Garfield-themed.
Does he have fur?
You mean Garfield? Nathfield.
Yes, does Nathfield have fur? Because I feel like he's bald except for the suit.
Oh, it's hard to tell. The picture of him, it looks like Garfield, right?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming he has fur like Garfield, but he does have human hair on the top of his head, which is when that is how you know he is not merely a Garfsona, he's a fursona as well. That's the dividing line between just an animal character and a furry, is it's got human hair.
Some furries have head fur, which is
basically
hair, but it's the same color as the rest of them.
Yeah, it's a little tuft that you see on cartoon, like mice in a Don Bluth film.
And if it's enough for children, they will have that in place of breasts, too.
That's true. Very Lady Cluck.
Yes.
Or maybe she had breasts? I don't remember now that I think about it.
Well, she's a chicken. Of course she has breasts.
But I mean, did she have, like, cleavage? I don't remember if they drew cleavage on her or the tuft.
I don't know. I think, they did reuse her animation for the football scene in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, but I forget who was doing that. If it was someone with cleavage or not.
Yeah, they probably deleted the cleavage from the Bedknobs and Broomsticks scene, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Because I don't think any of those chickens were ladies. I think they were, I mean, they were not chickens. They weren't chickens in that, were they? They're like jungle animals. It's the Wildcats versus the Jungle Dogs.
Yes, the Isle of Naboomboo.
Yes. So Nathfield appears to be is Garfield with a little bit of hair. He's wearing a suit. He may or may not have fur. I don't know. It's unclear because we only see this one static image of him. Nathfield had his own Twitter account, where he posted insane ravings, increasingly religious themed. He had not posted in a while last I checked.
Okay.
And he also had a podcast, 3 episodes before he gave up on this. And
3 episodes, less than 10 minutes each. And here we are on our 201st over an hour podcast. Masr, you are weak and we've outgrown you.
That's right. In fact, we've been talking about your podcast for about 40 minutes at this point, or actually just doing background on Nathan Masry in general. And we've already created more content than the entire run of the Nathfield podcast. And I'm going to wager that our even though we are rambling a little bit, I feel like we may be a little more coherent by the end. I feel like at the end of this podcast, you may feel like you've actually learned something about the world we live in, as opposed to the Nathfield podcast, which
I feel we've made more jokes that landed, too.
That's true. There were jokes in the Nathfield podcast. I did not understand a single one of them. They definitely seemed very Nathan Masry is gone full time cube, and these things will only make sense to him and not to us.
What was the thing I just shared with you about the two kids who go on a journey into the fourth dimension or whatever?
Oh, yes. I forget the name of it, but it was that weird self-published book by a child psychiatrist. And I think wasn't the point that Ritalin is bad or something. I think that was what they were trying to get at.
something to that effect. I mean, there was, they really didn't get to any specific point any more than, you know, now that they knew the truth, they were love children and nothing could control them.
I gotta say, I do love the 1970s were a time when there was kind of this, I think, a flowering of underground self-published works by kind of new age gurus and fringe psychologists, each trying to push some pet theory, and they would usually kind of turn them into very psychedelic children's fantasy stories. And I can't think of, when I think of that, I'm like, I can't think of a specific example, but that one you mentioned is when I said that and you showed it to me, I was like, that's it. That's literally the thing, the platonic ideal of what I'm saying.
I can think of another one. You know the Warm Fuzzies story?
I remember the Warm Fuzzies, yes.
Yeah.
The Warm Fuzzies and the Cold Pricklies.
Yes, and if you paint a cold prickly to look like a warm fuzzy, they call that a plastic fuzzy.
Oh, wow. This is actually more complicated theory than I thought. Now, I can't remember what the whole point of the Warm Fuzzies and Cold Pricklies were. I think I remember learning about them in kindergarten, and the idea was don't criticize. You're not supposed to criticize people.
Yeah, the idea being that, as I understood it, it was that some people were too, you know, were afraid that if they gave away their Warm Fuzzies, there wouldn't be enough for themselves. But then this lady with big hips called the Hip Lady came out and freely distributed her Warm Fuzzies and got them back.
Big hips, you say?
Yes, that's the Hip Woman. I don't know why that was relevant, but they're like, well, you know, you got to give her a limp and an eye patch so people will remember her.
Oh, okay. Well, it makes sense. She's very hip, so
yes,
big hips. It's the 70s.
Hippie,
that's
say.
The,
yes,
you know, that's the way we were. They were back then. Anyway, so outsider art. It's a thing to, I'm glad we have it. I'm glad that it exists in this world.
Yeah, this is not us complaining. This is just us just being like, wow, I remember that. Oh, no, yeah. I snorted. I'm turning into Billy the Pig.
Now, I think there is, like, outsider art can be, you know, a little rambling, a little incoherent, a little different. You know, sometimes it's a little harder to engage with.
A little horror vacui.
Yes. It can be something like, you know, the realms of the unreal. Or it could be, you know, an old Chinese man who stands in the town square with a big sign that says happy, 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 and tells you about how the founding fathers live in the eighth dimension and are, and also that the Dalai Lama sits on a throne made out of human skulls and sacrifices babies to his god, who is the devil.
Happy, happy, happy?
Yes. Yeah. Did you ever meet the happy, happy, happy guy?
No. Where is he?
So he was a San Francisco fixture for many, many years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was this guy in San Francisco. He had a big sign, and he was just so happy, 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 and he would just rant. And if you stopped and talked to him, you would get the whole spiel about how the founding fathers live in another dimension. One time, now I know of him because when I was in college down in L.A., he appeared there one day. He was just there for a day, and I was like, who the hell is this guy? What's this? And then I didn't see him for years and years and years until one day I was in San Francisco, and there he was. And I was like, it's the guy! And everyone's like, oh yeah, he's here all the time. Anyway, it turns out that apparently the Dalai Lama had gone to L.A. for some sort of summit, so he pooled all his money to come down to L.A., but they didn't let him in to see the Dalai Lama, so instead he went to my college and just stood there with a sign for hours. And anyway, yeah. So I don't know if he's still around. This was quite a few years ago, but outsider art, you know, it's a thing. So Nate, it's not always. I don't think you have to have it's not all created by people with mental irregularities. I don't know how the proper way to say this is. people with mental illness. I don't know.
I don't feel that I can criticize someone's mental state as being right or wrong based on my own. You know, I don't, you know, as Milk and Cheese put it, is not one man's truth a fallacy to the next man, especially if this first man is a big fat liar and always fabricating outrageous stories.
Yeah. I mean, it's like they say, in this world, only the insane have strength to prosper, but only those who prosper can judge what's sane. So, you know, think about it. But anyway, so not all outsider art has to... No, sorry?
And as the Tick said, you're not going crazy, you're going sane in a crazy world.
Man, ain't that the truth. That Tick knew what was what. Yeah, but so not all outsider art is you know, created by insane people, but the best outsider art is. And this is why the Nath Field is fascinating, because I didn't expect that his journey would take him in this direction ultimately.
Where do you think he was going to go next?
I really just thought we'd get more harebrained business schemes. Yeah. Just more of the same forever.
I thought that by now we had established that he was going to, he was going to get the actual item associated with a character just in time to have to associate it with another one. So after he did Scooby-Doo lasagnas, we were going to have, I don't know, Transformers branded Scooby snacks, and then we'd have to go on to Adventure Time branded Energon cubes or some shit like that.
yeah, exactly. Like that's what I kind of expected from him, to see just this constant day late and a dollar short hustle going on and on forever. We'd probably see him appearing on daytime talk show in Dubai where he explains his business. Eventually, I think we would probably get him selling seminars on business and explaining the secrets of Nathan Masry business to other suckers.
The incredibly successful Nathan Masry businesses.
Yes. But that didn't happen. And instead, he created this podcast to explain... I take it back. What's especially fascinating about the Nathan Masry trajectory, I think, is, you know, when you have people kind of go into this horror vacui psychotic break sort of mindset, very often, you know, there's religious mania associated. You know, here in the States, we get a lot of like Christian apocalypse imagery. Nathan Masry being from Dubai, his thing obviously involves a lot of Muslim imagery. But Nathan Masry seems like he's unique because he is continuing to hustle even as he descends into gibbering insanity, because he's got a new bag and it's this thing called Iggy's.
Yeah,
he's
now not Iggy's like Heathcliff's owner. It's definitely somehow derived from something he had done previously. Like, what the hell was Iggy's again? God, you know, I just listened to this 30 minutes ago, and I already have absolutely no memory of what's supposed to be happening.
It's derived from Enter Gage.
You know, he loved the word intergaging, so he squished it down into Iggy's.
Yeah, and so I listened, because Nathan Masry's Nathfield podcast has, I guess it's three proper episodes. There's a trailer, and there's also this weird ad for Iggy's, which appears to, they imply is the sponsor of the Nathfield podcast. Yes. But since Iggy's is really just Nathan Masry himself doing another thing, it's not really a sponsor at all.
Yeah,
so
it sounds, it's sort of like saying that our podcast is sponsored by, sponsored by Midnight Pals, which it sometimes is, because sometimes they retweet us when you remember to.
I'm a busy man.
Yeah. But, you know, it's not paying for it. Now, has it paid for anything for you?
No. I mean, I guess. One of these days,
It pays for the making of its own books. At least they're
that's
there.
True.
Yeah,
it broke even. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So all you Midnight fans out there, what the hell? Why aren't you going on my Patreon? Donate on Patreon. Unless you're stop being worthless. You know, give me money. Give me money because I want it. that's my best pitch, I guess.
That's how the Monster Telethon on the Jim Henson Hour started. You know, why do we need money? Because we want it.
I mean, you know, honesty is the best policy. But Nathan Masri, so Iggy's, it appears to be. Well, it's weird because this Iggy's, I guess, episode zero of the Nathfield podcast. It's Iggy's Presents the Nathfield. And it is basically a little interview between Nathan Masri and someone.
Yeah. It seems to be a clip from some other podcast, but they don't credit which one. So
yeah, it's very weird. It opens kind of in media res. So they're just talking about Iggy's. They don't introduce themselves. So you have no idea who either of them are. I was able to recognize Nathan Masri's voice because I've heard him enough. But otherwise, he doesn't say who he is. It's interesting because it's very clear that the person interviewing him also does not understand what Iggy's is. Because
I get it. And Nathan's like, no.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I worked briefly as a reporter, and I would very often have to do puff pieces on entrepreneurial fail sons who bought enough advertising in the newspaper that now we were obligated to like cover their bullshit ideas. And this was almost how every interview went, where they would basically say like, I've got a business that makes sandwiches. It's completely new. It's completely different. It makes sandwiches. I make sandwiches. And I would say like, okay, like Subway. And they'd be like, no, not like Subway. I make sandwiches. I have the bread. I put the meat on the bread. I put the cheese on the bread. They put the clothes in. Then you got your sandwich. It's sandwiches. Completely different. Nothing like that. And I'd just be like, oh, okay. You know, like they would basically, except they would explain it much more complicated. So you were never sure if you were actually following what was happening, but it was literally like, okay, gibberish. And you try to say, okay, you try to pin them down on, is it this? And they just say no. And the one thing that is funny is now whenever I read articles in the newspaper, I actually have kind of a good sense for when the reporter has no idea what the actual story is about. Because I'm like, yeah, I remember that. That's a phrase I would fall back on.
Yes.
You'd be right. Because when you have to write the article, I'd be like, I need to write this or I won't get my $50. New paradigm. It's a new paradigm. Synergy. Throw it in there. Whatever. Got to fill the content hole.
Sandwiches are a land of contrasts.
Yes. A lot of that sort of shit. So Iggy's appears to be, he calls it the Uber of licensing. But
nobody likes Uber.
Yeah, but it sounds like that you have to. It sounds like it's some sort of weird middle manager where if you acquire a license to some media property, and you don't know what to do with it, you can subcontract them to make merchandise or something, or let other people do merchandise. I'm not really sure.
Yeah,
because.
It sounded to me like you had to have already prepared the merchandise and Iggy's would, you know, let you search, you know, a whole database of merchandise featuring a given character.
Yeah. So it's really unclear what the advantage of Iggy's is, like why you would actually want it. Nathan Masri.
What does Iggy's do that Google does not, apart from, Google is failing, but you know, what does Iggy's do that, DuckDuckGo does not?
It's funny cause he uses the example of the Smurfs in his pitch for Iggy's, and his pitch is basically like, what if you got the license for the Smurfs? Everyone loves the Smurfs. The Smurfs are huge. Everyone recognizes the Smurfs. You could put them on anything and people would love it that you could just make $1 million with the Smurfs. And I'm like, You're okay, but that's a pitch for the Smurfs. That's not a pitch for Iggy's.
My favorite part is after that, the other interviewer goes, and the Smurfs are blue, right?
Yeah, he was just, I think at that point he just gave up. he was like a drowning man grasping for like anything to just like, he's like, at that point he's so lost. He's like, I don't even remember the Smurfs. I can't even picture a Smurf anymore. I'm so been talked in circles by so much by Nathan Masary.
I think he was, you know, legitimately expecting Nathan to go, no, the Smurfs are green. You need to adjust your TV.
Honestly, I would not be surprised if you, because Nathan Masary is exactly this kind of smooth talker who never gives you a straight answer. If you said Smurfs are blue and he would say something like, the Smurfs are actually they may appear blue, but actually, if you think about it, in the infinite theater of the mind, the Smurfs could be any color. You could merchandise Smurfs as green. You could merchandise them as blue. People would love Smurfs no matter what color. You could have Smurfs in every color. Iggy's could make this happen for you. The Smurfs have never just been blue, and you would just be like, okay. It's like if you say so. Yeah.
As long as you don't make them purple. Get out.
Oh, that's right. That you can't make them purple, or in the original comic, black.
Black, yes.
Yeah, the Hanna-Barbera adapted that different.
Yeah, they were smart too.
Yeah, they were probably like, should we do the racist Smurf story? No, let's change it.
Smurfs are black coded either.
That actually is. You're right. They. I guess that's one good thing about being originally a Belgian production, because if it was American, you'd have one black-coated Smurf, and he would talk in, like, rhyme.
Yes.
He would always be beatboxing.
That was how it worked in the 80s, yes. You'd have,
yeah, that was how it was back then.
Yeah, you'd have one black-coated person, and they'd say things like, into the ocean, let's be daring! The last one in is a rusty herring!
That's good. Did you just make that up?
No, that's something Jazz said on Transformers.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, Ethan, are you black?
Well, I do like peanut butter cookies. And grapes.
Is that a stereotype? I was going to say, peanut butter cookies? Is that a stereotype of black people that I was unaware of?
That's when I first started working at a grocery store. I was moving some cookies and I dropped a box of peanut butter cookies. And one of my coworkers said, oh, Ethan, why do you got to drop the black man's cookies? I was like, they are? I like them too. He said, that means you're black. And I'm like, really? Is that why I like grape soda too? And he just fell over laughing.
Man, well, I learned something tonight. I learned a new way to be racist.
Yeah.
Or not be racist. I mean, I guess it depends on how you use it. It's not racist to be like, black people like peanut butter cookies, because I guess we all
Everyone
do.
Fucking likes peanut butter
Don't
cookies.
We?
Yeah.
I mean, I think in general, most of us like peanut butter, you know?
Yeah. But I didn't think it was, you know, a racialized connection in the same way that, I mean, this is the one that always gets me. See, because mm-hmm. there are two major foods that are stereotypically associated with African Americans, and that's fried chicken and watermelons.
Right.
Now, mm-hmm. yes. they come from two totally different sources, though, because watermelons were what the freedmen were growing at the end of the Civil War, and they were making money off of it. And then fried chicken mm-hmm. comes from the stereotype of, you know, some poor black person stealing a chicken to get something to eat. So watermelons are like, fuck those rich blacks, and chicken is like, fuck those poor blacks. So it's like, yeah,
man,
you can't be anything.
That's America for you. I do remember an amusing racist story that I heard from a friend of mine. An amusing bit of racism. Oh, y'all laugh. This is quite a lark, this racism. Trigger warning right here for racism, I guess. Yeah. No, I had a friend who worked in a hometown buffet. And one time, for whatever reason, a large group of, I think it was a black family reunion came to the hometown buffet. And they were eating in the buffet. And they ate a lot of fried chicken. And my friend was talking to her. Apparently, she did not realize that was a stereotype. So she was talking to a coworker, and she was like, this family loves the fried chicken. They just They love it. They're going crazy for it. And everyone was like, you shouldn't be saying that. And she did. And so she learned how to be racist that night. Yeah. Anyway,
an observation of what's actually happening. You know, it's only racist if you know that it's associated with something racist.
I mean, it is unfortunate because fried chicken, I mean, it's good.
Yeah.
You know, everyone loves it. I feel like if I were black and I went to a restaurant, I'd be like, well, I can't order the fried chicken. It's going to be look all stereotypical. What the fuck? You know,
it's like go to a black owned fried chicken franchise. Then you're okay.
Oh, there you go. See, that's the problem. Is like me as a white person, it's very like sometimes you get that craving. I just want to eat some like American cheese and mayonnaise on plain white untoasted bread. But I can't do that. Everyone's gonna be like, "What a stereotype! Look at this dumb cracker."
So you got to go to a historically white-owned restaurant.
Go to you open the restaurant that's gonna serve like traditionally white food. it's gonna be all those delicious foods that white people love, like a split pea soup. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Pea Soup Anderson's whitest restaurant in America, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Because it's the most Danish restaurant in America.
Exactly. The Danes are very white. Milky white. Because of all that butter that they eat. let's see. In fact, you know, if you meet a Dane, that you know that when you first meet a Dane, they're often red. But you have to peel off that wax rind, and then you'll see that they're milky white beneath. anyway, I apologize. I feel like I am mocking your people at this point. Aren't you Danish?
Yeah, I am, but that's funny. I don't remember where baby bells come from, but that's funny.
Oh, I just assumed it was. Yeah, I actually don't know. See, we're allowed to do this thing because we're both white. We're allowed to like make white jokes at each other. This is totally kosher. We're reclaiming this
I don't even remember what you are. I don't, I don't think you make as much noise about it as I do about being Danish. So,
yeah. Well, I'm a mixture of things. I'm mostly German, and it was funny because for a long time, yes, I also used to believe I was Latino. But
I think it turns out too. But you might have been the one told me.
Well, my father's family is originally from Spain, so they are Spanish. But they basically traveled from Spain to the New World. They stopped in Puerto Rico on the way. So whenever I heard my family history, they were always talking about Puerto Rico. So I was like, oh yeah, we're Puerto Rican, right? Well, it turns out no, they stopped in Puerto Rico like overnight, and then just went to New York. So they've been stealing Puerto Rican valor for like, you know, the last 100 years. I do have a little bit of Venezuelan though. There is actual Venezuelan in my family.
That's neat.
Yeah. When I say actual Venezuelan, it may also just be Spanish people who went down there and lived for a few generations. I don't know how much, you know, indigenous, mixing they did. I don't know. Whatever. The point is, I'm pretty white bread, I think, which is why it's okay to make fun of white food, like the ones we mentioned, I guess.
Put in pea soup and that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
lentil soup, is that too Indian?
Oh yeah, lentil soup is a little too Indian because there's spices in it, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I would hope so. Yeah. Especially
well, let's
red
see.
Lentils.
If you,
yeah.
Well, assume okay. If you are, let's assume you are a racist. You are a racist
done
who decides
done.
You're only going to eat white food. Like, what would you actually be able to eat? What foods would that limit you to? You could eat
it would have to be stuff that you don't have to cook, like Twinkies.
Okay,
that kind of thing.
Twinkies. The Twinkies are pretty
spam.
White.
Yeah.
Right. Well, spam has a lot of associations with Asian culture now.
Yeah, it does have a lot of associations with a lot of, you know, Hawaiian and other island cultures. But, of course, it's also associated with England because they had to eat a whole bunch of spam thanks to wartime rationing. So
that's true. I guess English food is probably the whitest food because not only are the English very white, they seem to be the most racist about their food because... I mean, I may be wrong on this, but I get the impression, like, I've known people from other, you know, white countries, you know, in Europe, and they're like, there's some pride in their national cuisines, but England is the one where they're psychotic about it, where it's literally, they look at, like, a plate of beans, and they're like, this is what the war was for, you know?
No, this is what you had to start eating because of the war.
Yeah, well, apparently at some point they decided that, like, actually, no, the all those things that they had to eat because of rationing, they actually did it on purpose, and it was intentional because it's part of their English heritage.
I mean, I'm trying to think of stuff that came before, and I'm like, okay, what are they eating in, like, English fairy tales? I'm like, cheese and bread, okay?
Porridge, I guess?
Porridge. Yeah, okay. Gingerbread houses? No, that's German.
Yeah, that's German. Or as they say in America, Lebkuchenhaus.
Lebkuchen.
I saw a David DeCoto film. David DeCoto. The truth is out there. David DeCoto, our favorite Grindhouse director, the master of the male gaze in film, and he did an updating of Hansel and Gretel to be in, like, a spooky boarding school run by cannibals or something. I can't remember. It wasn't very good, but they kept talking about, like, oh, your dorm, it's called Lebkuchenhaus, and at the end they were like, yeah, and at the end they were saying, like, actually the reason we named it, it's German for gingerbread, and I was like, oh, you mean Lebkuchen?
Yeah,
it's not called Lebkuchen.
Lebkuchen.
Yeah, it's like David DeCoto. I mean, come on, we have the internet. Go look it up. You could get it right. This is a slander against my German heritage.
You know, there are way better ways to do. To do Hansel and Gretel as an actual horror movie. I mean, fucking Coraline is Hansel and Gretel. So,
oh, that's true. That is true.
You know, so, I think, okay, if you're going to make a Hansel and Gretel remake, here's my title for you. This is free. You can use it if you want. Gingerbread.
Wait, you cut out there. Say it again.
Gingerbread.
Oh, damn. That's actually really good. I'm going to steal that. Yes. There was a time, actually, for on the podcast I used to do with Orlina, where we actually reviewed, like, 20 different modernized Hansel and Gretel horror films. And wow. They're generally all very bad and low budget, but I think there are a couple where, for some reason, they decided to make it marijuana-themed, I guess. I think it was, like, Hansel and Gretel Meet the Evil Bong or something. I don't really remember that the gimmick was, but they weren't really worth checking out.
Some people are just so fat phobic that they have to switch gluttony over to drugs.
See, I don't couldn't be me. Why were we talking about? We just had, like, a 20-minute digression into, like, white culture. So hopefully, no one is going to listen to that section in isolation and be like, yeah.
"Well, now you know all about what being white is like." You know, tell your friends.
Yeah. And now you understand white culture. So yes. You're welcome. You understand what it's all about.
Yes. Didn't already learn all of this from your entire life in America. And every piece of media you've ever seen.
Yeah. But, you know, it's good because with the rising tide of fascism, you're going to experience a lot more white culture soon.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Anyway. You know what? White people suck. We should get rid of them.
No more Twinkies. No more lentil
soup.
Yeah,
no more Twinkies.
No more dipping your Twinkies in lentil soup.
What is that thing they do where they put, like, American cheese on apple pie? That's a white thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like a Pennsylvania thing. I think it's cheddar cheese. I know that.
Cheese.
Yeah, I know that was a thing in, like, Men in Black 3. Was that Jay was always, or Kay? I can never remember which one is which. You know, the older white guy was always eating cheese on his apple pie, And, you know, I don't have a problem with that.
Huh.
It's I mean, I don't like apple pie in the first place, but so, yeah. But cheddar cheese would probably make it better.
Yeah, I mean, hand, honestly, I could
apple pie. I ought to try that.
Hmm. What's mock apple pie? What's the difference with mock apple pie?
Mock apple pie is the whitest thing ever, but it's amazing. Mock apple pie is apple pie, but it doesn't use apples. It uses Ritz crackers.
Okay. It doesn't sound bad, but I guess my big question is, is there a reason to not use apples?
Because apples go bad.
Oh, so this lasts longer.
Yeah, it's a depression thing. So from
one gotcha, of the gotcha.
Harder to okay. get apples, and you know, it really just feels like you're like, look at me, I'm breaking up Ritz crackers and stirring them in a hot sugar solution. We're like, we're gonna make a pie. It's turning into apples. Witchcraft.
Man,
it's fascinating. Honestly, it's fun to do.
You know, I shouldn't throw stones because I do remember hearing on a television thing once about how in the 1950s, one of those popular sandwiches was a peanut butter and tomato sandwich.
Yeah, and you tried it, didn't you?
Yeah, and it was actually really good. So I was like, well, guess there's a reason all those, like, I don't know, 1950s people were eating this. I don't know what lives in the 50s. Beatniks, I think. Yep.
This is why people love that flamboyant screaming chef who does old recipes from 50s and 60s cookbooks.
Oh, James Lilacs?
No, he's this new guy who has some, Emerald-esque catchphrases like, we need two cups of moo juice.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've experienced him yet. He's a new one.
Yeah, he's a new one, and he is pretty good, and that's kind of what he does, is he tries old recipes, and usually it ends with him, you know, putting some in his mouth and being like, oh my god, oh, it's actually good. Oh, I was kidding.
Well, I mean, there's a reason people ate it in those days. Usually. I mean, there's also, like, a lot of aspects and stuff that people just ate because, well, they didn't, well, they didn't know what food was supposed to be. They hadn't perfected the science of eating.
I mean, people were still eating goblin sandwiches.
Oh, I need a goblin sandwich.
Okay. Well, here's how to make one. Goblin sandwiches. You need 18 donuts.
You need
one small can of deviled ham, one cup of Brazil nuts, one avocado, and Worcestershire sauce. Toast the Brazil nuts, roll fine with a rolling pin, add deviled ham and avocado, season with Worcestershire sauce, split the donuts through the center, spread lower half with filling, cover with second half. Serve 6 to 8.
I think I bit off more than I can chew.
Now, keep in mind, this calls for 18 donuts and it serves 6 to 8, so it assumes that some people are going to be like, more, 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 more.
Well, you know, it may be one of the things that is surprising, but I feel like I'm obligated to actually try making this since it's called a goblin sandwich.
Yeah.
Which is...
This is how you get goblinized.
Man, fully goblinized. Well, you know what? I'm going to invent a food and just name it after a goblin, and then everyone would have to eat that.
They knew that some people who identified with goblins were going to be like, well, I've got to eat it. It's a goblin thing.
It's part of my people. So I guess I'll have to eat this goblin sandwich.
This is from 1946. So
an avocado pear is just an avocado, right?
Right.
Alrighty.
I don't know why they called it an avocado pear, apart from that people didn't know what avocados were.
Man, this is just—it's just disappointing because it's like this is there's a lot of stuff in that sandwich that I'm not too keen on. A lot of stuff. Well, maybe there's other foods that are named after goblins I could eat instead. Let me just look up goblin food. No, I don't want to know what goblins actually eat. Goblin, you know what? What if
goblin
I look
recipes.
Up Yeah, Goblin Burger. What is a Goblin Burger? It's Goblin Good. Goblin Burger.
Cocktails. Goblin Good Warp Recipe.
Well,
is it anyway? Is it real Warp?
Only the finest. I guess I'll have to think of something to name after a goblin.
Okay, yeah, it is. It has peanuts and raisins, so it's GORP. And it's... because that's what GORP stands for, good old raisin and peanuts.
Oh, okay. Huh. Huh. Well, what a world.
Yes.
Anyway, we were speaking of Nathfield.
Okay, these... yeah, we were speaking of Nathfield, but along the way I've discovered this is my favorite goblin recipe right here.
Let's hear it.
These. I didn't even look at the recipe. I just saw the results. So, yeah, I want some of these.
Let's see. Oh, okay. All right.
I'm going to guess it's basically butterscotch haystacks with eyes, but they look like little tribbly things. So.
Yeah, they're little flying spaghetti monsters.
Yes.
Man, okay. I think I would probably be cool with whatever this is. I'm just guessing. I mean, it's probably like
white chocolate and lo mein noodles.
Hi, this is Mike. Just letting you know that we talked so much about Nathan Masri and the Nathfield podcast of three episodes that we had to split up in two of our own episodes. So join us next week for the conclusion of Nathan Masri and Nathfield.